You're listening to the podcast of the Biopharmaceutical Section of the American Statistical Association.
Statistics.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the podcast of the Biopharmaceutical Section of the American Statistical Association. This is Richard Zink. Today we are in episode 39, and I'll be speaking with Alex Dmitrienko, who is the current chair of the Biopharmaceutical Section. We talk a little bit about multiplicity, the FDA's draft guidance on multiple endpoints, and the ongoing pilot for the online training program. As always in these discussions, people are sharing their personal opinions, so please don't overinterpret their comments as representing the groups or organizations with which they participate. Now let's start the show. Hi folks, today I'm talking with Alex Dmitrienko, president of Mediana Incorporated and the 2017 chair for the ASA Biopharmaceutical Section. Hi Alex, thanks for being here.
Richard, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm very glad to be part of this podcast.
Now, before we get started, let's find out a little bit about you. How did you become interested in statistics?
That would take me back to my school days back in Siberia. That's where I grew up, and I developed general interest in mathematics when I was in high school. I decided to pursue a major in mathematics, and as an undergraduate student, I discovered that there was a lot more to mathematics than simply calculus. So I actually ended up having a very interesting major and studying an interesting mixture of different subjects, beginning with computer science and then applied mathematics and then probability theory. And it was the last topic that turned out to be my favorite, and I decided to apply for a graduate program to focus mostly on advanced probability theory, which was a very, very complex topic. But somehow during those 3 years of graduate studies, I started switching to statistics and doing a bit more applied research, and really fell in love with statistics. And as part of my work on discovering more about statistics, I began exploring available opportunities in the field of statistics in the United States. And this is when I decided to come to the United States. In 1995, I moved to the rolling hills of Lexington, Kentucky. And at that time, I pursued a doctorate in statistics from the University of Kentucky. And as a graduate student, I was expanding my horizons in applied statistics. I was remember doing a little bit of statistical analysis of cancer data at the university's medical center, and started developing a keen interest in clinical studies and biostatistics. I even published a quick paper based on my research work at the medical center. And at that point, I was very close to graduation, started looking for jobs, and I met Greg Innes, who was the head of global statistical sciences at Lilly at that time. That was 1998. He invited me to come to Indianapolis, and since I lived in Lexington, Kentucky at that point, it looked like a very important consideration to me that Indianapolis was relatively close to Lexington, Kentucky. And after moving to Indianapolis, I joined the growing statistical organization at Lilly, and this was actually the time of completely unprecedented growth for the company, because I remember that global statistical sciences were interviewing, I believe, as many as two statisticians every week, and almost they hired three or four statisticians every month. So I started discovering numerous opportunities to develop and apply innovative approaches. I was doing a little bit of work on QTC interval prolongation. I found for myself a exciting area of research aimed at multiplicity. I discovered the joy of multiplicity and adaptive designs, and I guess the rest was history.
Can you describe your current role at Mediana?
At Mediana, which I would like maybe to provide a little bit of background, it's a my new biostatistical consulting and software development company. I essentially continue to do more or less the same work that I've been doing over the past 10 years, and this is what I like to call strategic biostatistical consulting, and that goes once again back to my days at Lilly when, toward the end of my tenure at Lilly, I joined a statistical methodology group. I was not responsible for any particular project. I was my main responsibility was to help project statisticians across different therapeutic areas with innovative approaches, which included multiplicity, that included adaptive designs, that included biomarker-related research. I continued doing the same work at Quintiles, and I continue to do the same work. It's no longer limited to just one single company, as in Lilly's case. This is a set of, as I said, strategic biostatistical consulting services across the entire industry with clients in the United States as well as Europe, and that includes, once again, innovative designs, both early stage and late stage, and I'm beginning a bit more excited about adaptive designs in phase one and phase two trials. I continue to do a lot of work on subgroup analysis and biomarker-driven designs. Of course, my favorite topic of multiplicity in clinical trials. And just to maybe give you one quick example when it comes to multiplicity, which is my favorite topic, as I said, I've been actively involved in multiplicity research and consider myself to be one of the leading multiplicity experts in clinical drug development. So based on my research and consulting, general consulting experience, I'm very glad that I've helped create a number of efficient processes for developing multiplicity adjustments for fairly complex analysis, analytical strategies that help strengthen our product labels, and I've been very pleased to see how those methodological advances have been translated into very specific and tangible results and success stories for multiple clients. Again, starting back at my when I was working at Quintiles, and continuing at when I'm now working as an independent consultant at Mediana. But roughly speaking, we can say that probably close to maybe 50 phase 3 development projects have benefited from those novel and innovative approaches to addressing multiplicity. So we'll probably stop at this point because I'm sure we will come back to the topic of multiplicity in clinical drug development later in this podcast. But maybe I'll touch upon another very important topic. And that is, as part of my work at Mediana, I continue to provide contributions to open source software. In fact, we have developed over the past several years, an R package, which is also called the Mediana package, and it's being used by a large number of biopharmaceutical companies. It essentially provides a very systematic approach to clinical trial simulations in late-stage clinical trials. And I'm very glad that I've started receiving invitations to provide training on this open-source software. And would like to mention my collaboration with a number of people across the industry. For example, my longtime collaborator, Gauthier Paul, who works at the French pharmaceutical company, Servier, and also other members of the development team. I feel that this is a very important component of my work. Of course, I have to do a lot of work to make a living, but I also am so very glad that I can find time to contribute to the clinical trial community by supporting those open source software development projects.
Well, that sounds like a lot of exciting research and work, and certainly contributing software is a big component of getting methods out in the field and being used. Currently, you're the chair of the biopharmaceutical section of the ASA, and what are some of your goals for the section over the next year?
Thank you so much for asking this question, Richard. I'm very excited to serve as the section's chair this year. I started out as the chair-elect last year, and I feel that there are so many great things that we could do together, because, as you know, with great power comes great responsibility, and we need to very carefully plan our work. And just to share a bit more information about what we've done recently and what we're planning to do this year, I would like to mention that the past chair, section's past chair, Christy Clark, and I have recently written the so-called transition letter that happens every January, every February. And this transition letter will be published in the section's official publication, the Biopharmaceutical Report. The first issue of this report will come out in March or April. And in this letter, Christy has done a very good job of summarizing some major initiatives that we started or continued last year. That, of course, relates to our work on the biopharmaceutical sections, webinar series, various types of awards, student paper awards, poster award, best contributed paper award. That also includes, of course, the Your Great podcast series, Richard. And in this article, I've also outlined in very high-level terms some of the themes, initiatives that we'd like to focus on in 2017. And that begins with the natural extension of the webinar series that we started 10 years ago. And I know we'll probably talk about this a little bit later in today's podcast, but I'd like to mention very briefly that we're launching an online training program that will provide convenient and inexpensive training options for the section's members. I feel this will be a great example of service to our membership. Again, we'll talk in much more detail about the plan, about the pilot program that we've launched so far, what we've learned so far about online training. Secondly, I would like to mention that we're starting several new initiatives, or we're expanding existing initiatives to, again, provide service to the profession in general and our membership in particular. And a couple of examples I would like to mention is that we are spending more time on improving our work on the regulatory industry statistics workshop, because it's been attracting increasing attention across the industry. And as the workshop has been growing, there are certain issues, we might call them challenges, that need to be addressed. And I would like to mention for our listeners is that Richard has been very actively involved in this work, and I'm very glad that I can collaborate with him and other members of the executive committee on all those enhancements that will affect the way we the workshop is conducted. This will affect the offerings that will be available at the workshop. And secondly, we've been discussing options for creating awards for students to attract more students to consider careers in biopharmaceutical statistics. And I very much hope that this initiative that we're just beginning to discuss, those details will need to be nailed down in the future. The main idea behind this initiative is to encourage students to be actively involved with the section and essentially ultimately help raise a new generation of biopharmaceutical leaders. Maybe I'll say a couple of words about some of the work that's been going on behind the scenes, something that may not directly affect our membership, but we've tried several things that are aimed at improving our internal processes, because we are the largest ASA section. There are, we have multiple committees, we have now an increasing number of working groups. We have quite a few projects on our plate, and we realized that our processes may need to be restructured and improved to really improve our collaboration and support, for example, seamless transition for executive committee members. And even though this work, as I said, may not be appreciated by the membership, our ultimate objective is to provide better service to our membership. And I would like to use this opportunity to thank all of the members of the executive committee for their contribution to the section's work. And I've started working very closely with many of you, and I look forward to collaborating with you on multiple projects in the near future.
Well, great job working in a reference to Spider-Man. Kudos to you for that. But a lot of what you brought up, I think, is just, it sounds like growing pains. We've been very successful in offering things to the members and getting people involved, and it's just trying to figure out how to move forward in the most efficient way possible. So, yeah, it's an exciting time to be involved. And of course, I'm, I guess, hinting to the listeners to perhaps get involved and volunteer if they're interested in helping out. You're a regular fixture at statistical conferences, teaching on a variety of topics, including clinical trial design and analysis, multiplicity, and clinical trial optimization to enable better decision making. What motivates this level of involvement? It's obviously a lot of work to design and teach a short course. So, well, what makes it worthwhile for you?
Well, yes, you're absolutely right, Richard. It is a lot of work, and in my case, as I will explain in a few minutes, it's actually a lot more work than some people imagine. But as a very quick answer, I really enjoy, I just discovered earlier in my career that I really enjoy teaching courses, and that's what motivated me to prepare and teach literally dozens and dozens of training courses over the years. I've lost count, but it's probably been almost 50 over the past 15 years. And to once again just explain where I'm coming from, I actually started getting involved in developing training courses, programs on hot topics, quote-unquote, I guess, hot topics in clinical trial statistics back when I was a statistician, junior statistician at Lilly. And at that time, I collaborated with multiple statisticians as well as physicians, and I learned a lot from them on what it takes to create a successful, impactful training course. And I started getting very actively involved in developing internal training courses for Lilly statisticians, scientists, physicians in general, and it was very exciting for me to see how you can explain and bring up to speed your colleagues and answer their questions at the same time and share my own experiences. And for this reason, because of this background, my courses in general tend to be very practical. They're very case study driven. For example, if you take a typical course in multiplicity, and I've taught numerous versions of multiplicity courses, beginning with a two-hour course, then four-hour version, I have a full-day version, I have a two-day version, and it would just typically begin with a review of key issues that arise in clinical trials. I would typically give multiple examples based on real clinical trials that the participants can relate to. I would provide an overview of relevant theory, for example, the theory of multiple comparisons. I would begin with more traditional multiplicity problems and then continue to the discussion of more complex so-called multidimensional multiplicity problems. I always try to keep in mind that there is a very important gap, and we'll realize that this gap continues to exist between increasingly complex theories, methods that we develop in clinical trials, and clinical trial applications. And therefore, I always try to offer my courses a well-balanced mix of theories as well as applications, and spend a good amount of time on software implementation issues, because unless we have good, reliable software tools, it's next to impossible for a statistician, especially a junior statistician, to begin implementing those new methods. It will take forever to develop their own software implementation. And so after my experiences at Lilly, I started teaching half-day, full-day courses, courses at numerous conferences around the world. I'd like to mention, for example, that one of the training courses that was based on our first book for SAS Press became very popular, and we've been teaching it continuously since 2005. It's the full-day course entitled Analysis of Clinical Trials. And in fact, we discovered recently that it became the longest continuously running full-day course offered at JSM. Because, again, as I said, we've been teaching it since 2005, you know. And my main explanation is that, you know, there have been a large number of absolutely outstanding courses offered at JSM. You know, I've taken just a small number of those. And this one is a fairly applied course, you know, but just, I guess, the way we structured that, and we made it, we spent a lot of work on the slides, and we update the slides after every year after each one of those courses, just to make sure that junior statisticians, and this course is mostly aimed at junior statisticians who are new to clinical trials, that they will actually learn a lot from this course. And back your question, as you mentioned, it takes a long time to develop a training course, and what is worse in my case, as I said a couple of minutes ago, I'm a bit of a perfectionist, and it's my OCD side, and I do spend a lot of time. I begin on developing new courses. I begin with an outline and I add details, you know, and review and revise the course multiple times, and also try to write down most of the questions that we receive during our courses, training courses, and update presentation slides, just to make sure that all of those sometimes tricky aspects of the theory or implementation that I wouldn't personally pay attention to, that they're all addressed in the updated course. But I think, to summarize, that it's been worth it, because it's been a very rewarding experience for me, and I'm very glad that I can make this type of contribution to the biostatistical community.
Well, on that topic, the biopharmaceutical section has had a recent pilot program for online courses. What were the motivations for the pilot program?
Well, I'd like to thank you, Richard, for bringing this up, because I've been very excited about the future of webinars and online training. This topic is very important to me. You may say it's near and dear to my heart. And perhaps I could begin by telling you and our listeners a bit more about the webinar program, the Biopharmaceutical Sections webinar program that we started exactly 10 years ago in March of 2007. And it was at that time that I approached the section's leadership, and I'm very glad that they were supportive of that proposal. And I put together a quick outline of what we could accomplish with this new series. At that point, we called it the Distance Learning Series, and then we switched to the Webinar Series at some point a little bit later. And the argument that we discussed there, presented, and they were very well received by the section's leadership, was that we realized that travel costs and hotel costs are becoming increasingly more expensive. At the same time, travel budgets were getting cut, and not to be very negative, but we continue to see the same trends. You know, they've may have gotten slightly even worse over the past 10 years. And we thought that web-based communication channels are emerging as a low-cost way to deliver training, and therefore we should really emphasize that and think as we're thinking about additional services for our membership, how we can utilize web-based training that would allow our busy members to attend training when they cannot take, you know, a couple of days out of their busy schedule to attend a real conference and sign up for a live training. So we started this web-based training program in March of 2007, and it was extremely well received. The first set of courses included 5 courses. I contributed to that. It was a very nice 4-part series on the analysis of longitudinal and incomplete data that also attracted a lot of attention. And our overall impression, based on the positive feedback that we received, that both attendees and even presenters appreciated this new format because webinars were convenient compared to regular training courses. Attendees could easily log in those training courses from pretty much anywhere in the world, from their desk, from home. And in fact, what really made our day at that point, I remember, was that we were going through the logs. We were kind of trying to figure out how many people called in from the United States, from Europe, from other regions. And we discovered that there was one participant who called in from Afghanistan. It was most likely was a member of the military, and this was a great example of the power of web-based training. Wow. And as a natural extension of that, I'm very glad that this was a very important and successful initiative. I think that as a natural extension of this, we decided about a year ago to consider an online training program, because as much as we like the webinar program, and I'm very glad that it continues to be very successful and it's been going very, very strong, but there's an important feature of webinars is that they're not really designed to be archived, and therefore those webinars are not available anytime. And as an alternative, as an extension, as I said, of the webinar series, we propose to create an online training program. And the way it's going to be set up, and I'll tell you maybe in a minute about the pilot program that we started. This is just like the web-based training program. It's something that would provide convenient and inexpensive training options, and it will be based on pre-recorded videos. It is essentially very, very similar to YouTube videos that we enjoy, most of us enjoy on a regular basis. It's just the access to those videos will be controlled. You know, you'll need to sign up for those training courses. But they are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And just like the webinar series that became very, very successful, in fact, it encouraged other ASA sections to develop their own programs. We very much hope that this online training program will also become successful. And we're actually, as I'll tell you probably in a couple of minutes, we're already beginning to see how individual pharmaceutical companies are taking advantage of this new online training program. And perhaps this will also encourage other ASA sections to create similar programs, which will be an example of how we're not only serving our membership, we're serving the entire profession. So perhaps I will just stop at this point to see if you have any additional questions, Richard.
Well, can you tell us what's in the current pilot program and how you'll determine whether it's successful and your plans for moving forward in the future?
Yes, and I'm very glad, once again, that the section's leadership was very supportive of the initial proposal to set up the section's online training program. And we started at the end of last year discussing the specific steps that we'll need to take to really assess the level of interest across the section. And we came up with this idea of setting up a pilot program which would provide discounted access to the currently available short courses, just to, as I said, just to gauge the general interest level across the section. And we're also, as part of this pilot program, we're also identifying short courses that can be incorporated into this program over the next year. And currently, the pilot program, which is available right now, and I'll tell you in a second how to actually access those courses if you're interested. Currently, the pilot program includes several short courses that have been offered at numerous conferences around the world. They've been field tested, if you will. The first one is the analysis of longitudinal and incomplete data. This was something that I mentioned a few minutes ago when I was discussing the origins of the webinar program that we started back in 2007. We had a four-part webinar, which was based on this particular course. In fact, this course has received multiple awards at GSM. There's also a course on statistical evaluation of surrogate endpoints in clinical trials and key multiplicity issues in clinical trials, which is based on multiple live courses I've taught over the years. And for our listeners, if you would like to learn more about this online training program and this pilot that we have developed, I would like to mention that we have written an article for the Biopharmaceutical Report, which is once again our official publication. And the first issue will be available quite soon. And there's more information in this article about the courses, and there's also a link to the website where the online training courses are available. We have started receiving feedback, as I said, on this pilot program, and we've included some of that feedback into the article. So I'd like to encourage you to give it a try. And if you have any suggestions, any feedback, any thoughts on any other topics that would need to be covered as part of this online training program, I would really appreciate your feedback.
Well, that sounds good, Alex. But do you envision any challenges moving forward with the online courses or online training in general?
Given the experience that we've had more experience with web-based training programs than any other section within the association, as I have explained. To be honest, we don't anticipate any major challenges at this point, at least. As I said, we started working on this pilot. We're exploring different options. We will try to be as adaptable as possible. Perhaps I could mention one feature of online training, that it is not timeline-driven and there is no sense of urgency, and that is something that we have started noticing as we're exploring this pilot. Because, as I said a few minutes ago, unlike a conference or even a webinar from our webinar series, that will take place at a certain time, and it forces you to make a decision to sign up for it. The online courses that we've been discussing, they're available 24/7, and it's easy to postpone a decision to take advantage of them, to register for them. And we have received actually quite a few emails from multiple organizations, biopharmaceutical companies around the world, and they're interested in registering for the program. But I'm beginning to see a trend that the actual decision to sign up for those training courses is delayed, mostly because those organizations are trying to find a convenient time for all of the participants. Yeah. And I think it's absolutely normal, but it's just taking us longer to understand the level of interest, because we see a lot of interest, but a lot of those organizations have not signed up yet. But once again, it simply tells us it's a very flexible setup. Those courses are indeed available 24/7. And once again, I would like to encourage our members to take advantage of this training program.
Well, I want to switch topics briefly. So this past January, the FDA released a draft guidance on multiplicity entitled Multiple Endpoints in Clinical Trials. Now, we've discussed already that you've done a lot of work in this area. Why, just for people who may not be as familiar, why is multiplicity so important in clinical trials?
That's a great question to ask, Richard, and it would normally take me about maybe 2 hours to answer this question, because that's the length of my shortest training course. But I will try to give you a 1-minute version in the interest of time. And very briefly, multiplicity issues are increasingly common in modern drug development as modern clinical trials. I'm talking mostly about confirmatory phase 3 clinical trials. They are designed now to investigate multiple objectives. That includes evaluation of multiple endpoints, multiple clinical endpoints. You see multiple doses or regimens compared to a control. There's a lot of interest now in the general topic of tailored therapies or personalized medicine, and therefore there's a lot more examples that we see of biomarker-driven designs that are set up to explore multiple subgroups. So to summarize, I think it will be fair to say that trial sponsors these days attempt to accomplish much more in a single trial compared to, say, 15 to maybe 20 years ago or beyond 20 years. Because 20 years, when I just joined the pharmaceutical industry, you know, it would have taken probably two or three trials sometimes to evaluate the same set of clinical objectives. But now there is much more emphasis on efficiency, which probably reflects simply the increasing level of competition in the marketplace. And that ultimately leads to the desire to assess very complex goals in a single trial or in a single program, and to be able to pursue all those goals or to support analysis to pursue those goals. Clinical trial sponsors, you know, end up facing complex multiplicity issues. And that, of course, leads to the need to adjust for that multiplicity, because we know that if we don't do that, we're going to end up with a set of spurious conclusions because the type 1 error rate will be concerned. But what is important for us to know that much progress has been made in this research area, and a large number of novel, very interesting multiplicity adjustment methods have been proposed in the literature over the past 10 to 15 years. We can think about this as the golden age of multiple comparisons. And I'm very glad to see that many of those methods have found applications in clinical trials. So once again, I can talk about this for hours. It's a very important set of topics. And the reason, once again, I would like all of us to pay more attention to this topic is because we have seen quite a few large and expensive clinical trials that failed, or they were considered failures because of an inefficient way of accounting for multiplicity. And I've seen it happen multiple times, and still a heartbreaking experience, you know, because you know how much work goes into designing and to conducting and analyzing those clinical trials, but you realize at the end of the day that if a better, more flexible, or more powerful multiplicity adjustment had been employed, the trial outcome would have been positive. So this is why it is important for us to pay attention to this set of issues, and this is why I'm so glad that we see a lot of attention from researchers in academia and the pharmaceutical industry aimed at developing and applying some of those interesting novel multiplicity adjustments in real-life clinical trials. So, Richard, I promised a one-minute version, but it's probably been more like 3 minutes. I will stop at that point.
That's okay. That's okay. I won't charge you for it. Well, do you think, I mean, based on that description, do you think statisticians get sufficient training into the concepts of multiplicity during their training? And even non-statisticians, I mean, they may have one statistics course and maybe they may be introduced to Bonferroni correction, but, you know, given the collaborative environment of drug development, I mean, do you think that non-statisticians fully appreciate the importance of multiplicity and the adjustments? And what are your thoughts on all of this?
Yes, Richard. Yes, that's yet another great question, and actually a very important topic for all of us working in the biopharmaceutical industry. But speaking of how we can educate, train our colleagues, non-statisticians, it's a very challenging set of issues, because in general, the group of non-statisticians is, of course, very diverse. We have general scientists, we have statisticians, we have physicians, we have people who work in data management and different other aspects of clinical drug development. There are different types of statistical issues that may be specific to individual therapeutic areas. And as I'm thinking about this, it's not really easy to establish efficient communication across, let's say, different medical societies, even in the United States, simply because there are just so many different societies and associations. But I think we definitely need to work more in this direction, because based on my experience, and that's part of the consulting work that I do on a weekly, monthly basis, is I work with a large number of mostly smaller to mid-sized companies out there, and really try my best to bring them up to speed when it comes to a very broad set of multiplicity related issues. That also applies to adaptive designs, by the way, because most of the time when we struggle with the design of some of those complex adaptive trials, because we don't know how to properly adjust for multiplicity. And I hope that the biopharmaceutical section will perhaps get involved in this work. Maybe we could even create an online course, as we started talking about the online training program on the general topic of clinical trial statistics for non-statisticians. It doesn't have to be just multiplicity. Maybe invite leading experts from different areas of clinical trial statistics. And maybe just to share a few thoughts from my personal experiences, as I told you 10, 15 minutes ago, back when I was at Lilly and I was a fairly junior statistician, I was getting actively involved in developing different internal training programs. I was also fairly keenly interested in this topic of how to educate our non-statistical colleagues. And I remember that with one of the physicians, Greg Sides, we even co-wrote a booklet which was over 50 pages on key statistical issues in clinical drug development. It was published at Lilly. It was actually fairly successful at that time, and I hope it is still being used. Maybe that's something for us to consider potentially in the future. But along the same line, coming back to your question about how to bring our colleagues up to speed on the general topic of multiplicity, I would like to mention that Professor Ralph DeAgostino of Boston University and I have been invited to write a paper or tutorial on multiplicity for New England Journal of Medicine. I was very excited to be invited to contribute to New England Journal of Medicine, because it's one of those publications which is very, very widely read and respected in the clinical trial community. We're almost done with that, and we've, again, being perfectionists, you know, spent a lot of time going back and forth and really fine-tuning some of those issues, beginning with the fundamental multiplicity problems arising in phase 3 trials, and really emphasizing the case study-driven approach to explain the reason why we have to worry about multiplicity, how to address those multiplicity issues that commonly arise in confirmatory clinical trials. So that is based, once again, on my personal experiences. If any of our listeners have any thoughts to share, maybe it would help us in identify appropriate communication channels for reaching out to non-statisticians. I would love to hear your thoughts.
That's an interesting idea, and maybe if the online training takes off, there can be a second component that could help train non-statisticians in areas that are important to statisticians. So that's a pretty exciting future possibility as well. Just want to go back to the guidance document. Any initial assessments on the breadth or depth of the multiplicity guidance that was recently released? It's still in draft form, I believe.
Yes, it was released in mid-January, and I was personally happy, very, very happy to see that the FDA finally released its draft guidance on multiple endpoints in clinical trials, and so were quite a few statisticians across the industry. And the main reason for that is that, you know, that it's been probably close to 7 years that since the FDA statisticians and medical reviewers started working on these guidance documents. So I was very pleased to see it that it's finally available for us. I know it's just a draft guidance, but it's a very well written document. I finished reading it in just 1 hour. I went through it very very quickly, and I think this document does a very good job of covering the fundamental principles of multiple comparisons. It also emphasizes a good number of practical issues arising in confirmatory clinical trials that employ multiple clinical objectives. It provides detailed information on traditional, and as I mentioned a few minutes ago, some of the more advanced multiplicity adjustments that we see are commonly used in modern clinical trials. That includes, for example, the so-called gatekeeping strategies for clinical trials with multi-dimensional multiplicity problems. So I would like to use this opportunity to congratulate our colleagues at the FDA for preparing this informative document, and I very much hope that this draft guidance will encourage drug developers to learn more about novel approaches to performing multiplicity adjustments, addressing multiplicity in general in phase three clinical trials. I explained why it's important to do that, and unfortunate consequences of sometimes failing to properly adjust for multiplicity. And to come back to your question about my overall impression, I do have a number of minor comments, but perhaps my main comment is that the draft guidance focuses only on multiple endpoints, and I know it reflects the title of the draft guidance because the title is Guidance for Industry, Multiple Endpoints in Clinical Trials. But it's a bit of an artificial distinction from a methodological perspective, and I initially thought, perhaps about 8 years ago, before the work on this guidance document started, that it would be a guidance document on a broad set of multiplicity issues that we encounter in confirmatory trials. And as we've talked about trials with multiple doses compared to placebo, or about the increasingly popular biomarker-driven designs that sponsors can use to win in one or more patient populations. It's almost now the gold standard in oncology drug development. This guidance focuses only on multiple endpoints, and certain commonly used methods are not, because of that, they are simply not mentioned in this guidance. There is no mention of the Donut or similar tests, which may be a limitation, but I think it will be quite easy to address. And by the way, speaking of comments, I know that multiple companies, because it's a multiplicity issue, of course, they've been working on gathering and organizing comments on this draft guidance, and would like to remind our listeners, if it's not too late, I know that the comments are due on March 14th in just a few days, so if you happen to enjoy this podcast before that deadline, you know, I'd like to encourage you to remind you that you should submit your comments in case you have any comments on this draft guidance.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. It's important for the industry to share their feedback on guidance documents when the opportunity presents itself. Well, I want to finish up with a couple questions about some upcoming books that I believe you have. The first is on clinical trial optimization, and I think this was a short course at the Regulatory Industry Statistics Workshop last year. Can you describe this work for us?
Yes, I appreciate the opportunity to tell you, Richard, and our listeners about my recent work on clinical trial optimization. I guess I've been thinking about the general topic of optimization, how we can optimize our clinical trials and development programs, since I joined Lilly, but it was only recently that I read a very interesting paper on clinical scenario evaluation. It was probably about 6 or 7 years ago. by Norbert Benda and his colleagues. Norbert was at Novartis at that time, and he is now at the BfArM, which is the German regulatory authority. He's the head of the biostatistics unit. And it was a very, when things kind of all of a sudden just clicked into place. And in very simple terms, what Norbert Benda and his colleagues introduced this idea of clinical scenario evaluation as a very systematic approach to assessing candidate trial designs and applicable analysis methods in clinical trials. And I thought that this was a very powerful concept and very powerful framework that really encourages us to apply a quantitative approach to assessing all the information that we have to support ideally optimal decision making for individual projects. And this is when I started thinking and maybe even drafting some papers on clinical trial optimization, because I believe that if we take it seriously, it will help us build efficient trial designs and identify powerful as well as robust analysis methods. And the ultimate goal here is to improve and maybe even try to maximize the probability of success in clinical trials, which is a very important component of any statistician's work. Maybe it should be a very important component, because as we know that the rate of success in phase 3 trials has been declining over the years, quite unfortunately. So we started working on this book a couple of years ago. It was co-edited by Edik Pulkstenis of MedImmune and myself. We've been very lucky to work with multiple contributors from the United States and European pharma companies. Just to mention once again my longtime collaborator, Gauthier Paul, who works at Servier. And what I personally like about this book, and I hope the future readers will appreciate this, is that it puts emphasis on practical and easy-to-implement clinical trial optimization strategies. It employs a case study-driven approach. We spend a lot of time discussing software implementation using the Mediana package that I've mentioned before, because once again, we know that there's this very important gap between theory and the applications in clinical trial statistics, and how should we expect clinical trial statisticians to use some of those advanced statistical methods when there is no software available? So that's, of course, we thought about this, and I'm glad that we have a powerful R package that accompanies the book, the methodology presented in this book. And as you said, Richard, and you have an amazing memory, by the way, you remember the short course that I taught on this topic at the Regulatory Industry Statistics Workshop. Last year, I was very pleased that it was sold out. I felt that the course was well received, which again tells us that it's an important topic, and I will definitely continue working on clinical trial optimization. And once again, perhaps we could add this course to the section's online training program, and it will be a great opportunity for me to share my experiences with clinical trial optimization with our section's membership.
It sounds like an interesting book. When do you think it's going to be released?
We submitted the book, the manuscript, in December, and I believe it will be available as early as May or June. It will be for sure available at major statistical conferences during the summer, including GSM.
Very good. And the second book I think you have coming up is Analysis of Clinical Trials Using SAS. This is a second edition. So what topics have you added to the second edition, and can we expect the clinical trials course that we were talking about earlier to be updated based on these new topics?
Yes, that's another book publishing project, and it seems a little crazy because it's been a challenging year working on so many different things at the same time, including two books. But the good news in this case is that this is the second edition of an existing book that was released. The first edition was published in 2005. It was fairly well received. As you mentioned, we built our GSM course around this. And the original book was had more or less the same overall goal as our clinical trial optimization book, is that we just wanted to select a number of practical problems that statisticians, clinical trial statisticians face on a daily basis, discuss solutions of those problems, make use of the powerful SAS environment. For the second edition, I'm very glad that I've been able to enjoy to collaborate with Professor Gary Cook, who is the book's co-editor. This will be, unlike the first edition, this book will be a collection of edited chapters. This whole process has been overseen by Professor Cook and myself. So we've expanded the book by inviting a large number of contributors from SAS Institute, from academia, from pharmaceutical companies. We've added a number of topics. For example, we have now chapters on early phase trials, and we've expanded the chapters from the first edition that includes analysis of multiplicity issues in clinical trials, analysis of incomplete data in clinical trials, and group sequential trials. So I really enjoyed working with those people, including yourself, Richard. Maybe I could use this opportunity to thank you for contributing to the second edition of our book. That was
thanks
great.
Thanks for the invitation.
Very much appreciated, and hope those updates will be appreciated by the book's readers, and as you said, maybe we should consider updating the clinical trial course, which is offered at GSM, by adding those new topics from the second edition.
Any expectation on when the book will...
It will be published. I think it will be published at about the same time. SAS Press is a smaller and much more flexible publisher, so it doesn't take them typically as long to publish a book.
Very good.
Yeah, so maybe in June, so it should be available at GSM for sure.
Oh, great. Well, congratulations on both books.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
And thanks again for your time today. Good luck with the success of the books and your participation in the biopharmaceutical section as chair.
Well, thank you so much, Richard. I appreciate your invitation, and enjoy this opportunity, and I've listened to a number of podcasts in this series. I'm very glad I've contributed to this podcast, finally, myself. So thank you so much, Richard, and thanks a lot, everybody.
And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Lots going on in the biopharmaceutical section. Keep an eye out for clinical trial optimization using R, edited by Alex and Eric Polkstenis. An analysis of clinical trials using SAS, edited by Alex and Gary Cook. Interested in presenting your work at the Regulatory Industry Statistics Workshop this fall? You have 2 weeks left to submit an abstract for a poster. Head on over to the BioPharm website and submit it today. If you have an idea for a podcast, send me an email at richard.zink@jump.com. That's richard.zink@jmp.com. Until next time.